Mr. Scurran.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The starting point in this case is the undisputed fact that Reginald Purvis does not have two predicate convictions for purposes of a career offender enhancement under Sentencing Guideline 4B1.1. We know that because the Illinois court system has vacated one of his prior convictions, and as a result...
What's the current status of that? He's being prosecuted again, I understand. What's the current status?
That is correct, Your Honor. As of yesterday, the case was still pending. The last event in that case took place on August 3rd, at which point the state requested a continuance so that it could communicate with the government, presumably in this case. So that is still pending. However, the pendency of that prior conviction does not matter for purposes of this case because, as argued in the opening brief, and as the government apparently does not dispute in its brief, under 4B1.1, you need to set, even if he were to reacquire that conviction, it would be irrelevant for purposes of the career offender enhancement. The sentencing guidelines are clear that you must have an extant conviction, the requisite two convictions at the time.
Do the sentencing guidelines talk about what happens if a conviction is set aside, is extant at the time of the federal sentence, but is set aside after the federal sentence?
Yes, Your Honor, they do speak about that, and they are clear that you cannot consider a vacated conviction in calculating the career offender guidelines. Also,
look. Sentencing guidelines ranges are calculated at the time of sentencing. I don't see how the sentencing guidelines could say what you're supposed to do when a state conviction is set aside long after sentencing.
Well, as...
Think about this the following way. Suppose the state trial court had set aside this particular conviction and the state court of appeals had reversed and reinstated it. Would you say that therefore, he had to be resentenced under federal law because the conviction went away and the later reinstatement didn't count? Couldn't possibly be right.
I don't believe that would be correct, Your Honor. And in any event, that is not what occurred in this case. The sentence has been vacated, and the sentencing guidelines are clear that under 4B1.1, and this would be in the opening brief at from pages 30 to 33, that the sentencing guidelines require sentence based upon convictions that were extant at the time that the events for which you're being sentenced as a career offender took place. In other words, you lock down...
Yes, counsel, but that's... Hope you can see your client had been convicted. There was an extant conviction at that time. The question is, what happens when a conviction that was extant is set aside, vacated and reinstated, vacated and re-prosecuted? But we don't have to worry about that here. The point of my question was just to figure out what was going on in state court. And the fact is that at the moment, he does not have a new conviction to replace the old one.
That is correct, Your Honor, at this point. There is no underlying conviction. And under Johnson versus United States, the fact that that prior conviction has been vacated renders him ineligible for his career offender enhancement. And under Johnson, that fact means that he is entitled to not be considered a career offender so long as two things occurred, which are really the two procedural issues in this case. The first procedural issue being, what should a petitioner do under 2255 when faced with...
Yeah, I have one other question about status. Was Rines against Weber called to the district court's attention?
I do not believe that it was, Your Honor. I was not counsel there. Mr. Purvis was pro se at that time.
All right. So he didn't... Purvis doesn't know which end is up. And I gather you're saying the state didn't call Rines to the district court's attention. Because Rines is by far your best line of argument, the district court should have treated this as partially exhausted and stayed it.
That is absolutely correct. That is one of two ways the district court could have proceeded and should have proceeded in this case. Either under Rhines, which involves very similar facts, albeit involving state claims under 2254, but unexhausted state claims, and there the Supreme Court clearly said what you do here is you stay the petition, and that's one possibility.
What you do here, the Supreme Court says, is stay the petition if it looks like the unexhausted claim has any prospects.
That is correct, Your Honor.
I take it that your client did say to the district court that the state's attorney had agreed to do something about that judgment.
That is correct as well.
It suggests, if true, that the claim did have prospects.
That is correct, Your Honor. It's very clear that under the Rhines test, and there are two other prongs which are not relevant here under Rhines, the no intentional delay, which comes from the death penalty aspect of it, as well as the
Of course, it wasn't only Rhines. This circuit had anticipated Rhines in about 1999, telling district judges that when they get partially exhausted claims, they should be stayed if there's any prospect.
That is correct as well.
One would always hope that district judges would know the law of the circuit and the U.S. Supreme Court, even in a pro se case.
That is correct.
The district court treated this not as unexhausted, though, but as essentially premature or unripe. And is that a material distinction for purposes of the Rhines doctrine?
I don't believe so, Judge Sykes. The fact of the matter is, if you look at Rhines and if you look at what happened here, both involve claims that had not been exhausted, could not have been exhausted, were in the process of being pursued, and as a result, the proper course is to stay. The alternative method of proceeding would be suggested by the 11th Circuit's recent decision in Stewart, where the 11th Circuit just this last July 14th said, well, when faced with a situation precisely like the one that we have in Mr. Purvis's case, we should treat that claim dealing with vacated sentences as not successive for purposes of 2255. That would be the alternative under this court's precedent, and under Rhines, the stay would be another possibility.
Which approach do you think makes more sense?
I think that perhaps the course of the 11th Circuit would make more sense because it would promote judicial efficiency in that you never have to wait to find out what will happen in the underlying pending cases before you can resolve the current 2255 AEDPA claims, the ones that are timely, that can be dealt with. And in many cases, if there's no success in having the underlying conviction vacated, then there's no need to come back and re-review the situation. I think that either course is very acceptable. Either course has support in judicial precedent. That one might
be
slightly more efficient.
One of the two courses has support in the language of the statute.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
And one of the two courses has support in the language of the statute, the Rhines course.
That is correct.
The other one might think, is in the teeth of the language of the statute, which might suggest which one is preferable.
That is possible as well, Your Honor. So I think that addresses what should have happened in this case. I think that what Mr. Purvis did in this case, especially proceeding pro se, was precisely what he needed to do. He said, I have a one-year timeline under AEDPA. I file my 2255 petition timely under AEDPA within 1 year of the Supreme Court's denial of cert in this case. And in that filing, I notify the district court that I have this pending claim that challenges my underlying state conviction, and therefore, at that point, what else was he supposed to do at that point? The government's view is that if you are a petitioner in the unfortunate situation of facing that unfortunate situation, you have to do one of two things. you have to either forever forgo your current 2255 claims within the one-year AEDPA window, or you have to forego any possibility that if you subsequently are successful in pursuing vacatur of one of your underlying convictions, you can't bring that. Take a pick, choose which one you want. You can't have both. That's not the purpose of AEDPA. The purpose of AEDPA is to push individuals towards using their claims efficiently. I see that the time has gone on for my rebuttal, but I would like to just mention that the other issue in this case is the due diligence question, and there Mr. Purvis did exercise due diligence. He spent the 14 and a half months between the time of his conviction and the time at which he filed to have his state predicate vacated. He spent it arguing that he should not have been sentenced as a career offender on direct appeal, on different legal grounds, still attacking his career offender status. He spent that time preparing the filings for this petition, and for that reason he should be held diligent. I'm unaware, nor has the government cited any case in which 14 and a half months was undiligent. And the Supreme Court in Johnson clearly says that that is an indeterminate number of how much is too much, indicating it's a facts and circumstances test. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Scarron. Mr. Paganini.
Hey, please the court. Scott Paganini for the United States. I'd like to address the court's questions regarding Rhines and Newell. There is a distinction between an unexhausted and an unripe claim. In Johnson, the court held that vacated state court, the predicate conviction, is a new fact under 2255F4. And as such, it is a necessary condition to obtaining the 2255 relief to vacate that conviction. So essentially, there is no claim until the state court has vacated the predicate conviction. So in this case, Mr. Purvis filed his Johnson claim 9 months prior to receiving the vacated state sentence. It was unripe. This court has followed a similar procedure in Unthank versus Jets. And in that case, this court said...
Why does this nomenclature matter? Is that a good reason why the district court should disregard the procedure under Rhines?
Yes, Your Honor, because there is no claim. In this case, the alternative is that...
Look, one can say that an unexhausted claim is no claim. It's nothing the federal court... Until a claim is exhausted, federal court can't consider it, and it can't be the basis of relief. So one could describe that as no claim. It's not anything on which a federal court can grant a petition. But Rhines says that under those circumstances, when the federal court can't give relief on ground X, but must wait for the states... The sensible thing to do is stay the proceeding. Now, you've given a reason why the federal court couldn't grant relief but must wait for the state, but that was the premise of Rhines, that the federal court couldn't grant relief on that theory but must wait for the state. I don't understand why these should be treated differently.
Because the Johnson court has said specifically that it's a necessary condition to obtain relief, and until that there is no claim.
The exhaustion of the claim is a necessary condition to obtain relief in federal court. Right? You've got a necessary condition here. There was a necessary condition in Rhines. Why should the two conditions, both of which require going to state court first before a federal court can do anything, be treated differently? That's my question.
And, Your Honor, I have to refer back to Johnson because the Supreme Court has held them differently. It's stated that the vacated state court sentence is the new claim, that it is unripe. There is no claim. So whether it's exhausted or not is not the issue. It's whether or not there even is a claim.
Well, even if we accept that iteration of the argument, you're going to run into problems under the Supreme Court's decision in Panetti. So if this is characterized as an unripe or a claim that has not yet arisen, so if a Johnson claim is properly characterized not as an unexhausted claim, but one that is unripe or not yet in existence or that has not yet come into being, then you're going to run into the Panetti decision, which
yep.
specifically said that an unripe Ford claim doesn't qualify as second or successive under AEDPA, and can be brought without that threshold having to, statutory threshold or standard having to have been met?
The distinction, Your Honor, is this isn't a second or successive. This is his initial claim. But it was initial claim that he filed seeking ineffective assistance of counsel. He did not cite Johnson in his initial petition because it was not ripe at the time. He attempted to stay that, but the district court correctly denied the stay because it didn't relate back to his initial petition, which sought ineffective assistance of counsel based on Fourth Amendment grounds for the search and seizure and Fifth Amendment grounds for the fact that his indictment was unconstitutionally amended when he was sentenced as a career offender. So this isn't a second or successive. But this court in Unthank has held, in Unthank versus Jett, that if Mr. Unthank wanted to argue for a lower sentence in his 2255, he only had to refrain from filing a collateral attack until the state court had acted.
That is based on the premise that it's a second or successive.
Well,
the whole premise of that decision was that this was actually, in that case, I think it was a fourth or fifth, a second. Here we've got what could be either characterized as a second or a claim that was folded into the first and should have been stayed. Well, so it's got to be at one end of the spectrum or the other, and the question is, which is it closer to? You've got problems with Supreme Court precedent either way.
That's true, Your Honor, but in Unthank, it
that
was...
That sounds like a concession to me.
If the court is going to treat this as a second or successive, or if it's going to treat it as an unexhausted, then yes, there is going to be, we're going to run into Rose versus Londin, we're going to run into Newell and certain other Supreme Court cases. But like I said, the government does not believe this is an unexhausted claim. This is an unripe claim because of what Johnson distinguished and said that it
then
is a new
claim. Then you've got a problem with Panetti.
But Panetti is a second or successive.
What I said earlier is that Panetti is in the teeth of the language of the statute, but that was the basis of Justice Thomas's dissent. And like it or not, we do follow the majority opinions. And the majority opinion in Panetti gives you a lot of trouble, does it not?
It does, Your Honor. But again, if the court is going to turn this as a second or a successive, then we run into this court's decision in Hope. And in that case, this court held that a second or successive petition cannot be used to argue against the sentence unless the petitioner is challenging the conviction.
That is just an application of the AEDPA standard for second or successive petitions. What Panetti said is that a Ford claim cannot be characterized as second or successive because it's unripe until the competency issue manifests itself. Here, I mean, if a Johnson claim is akin to a Ford claim because it's unripe until the state court vacates the underlying conviction, then it falls outside the definition of a successive, second or successive. The AEDPA standard doesn't apply. It's in the door and gets consideration on the merits, plenary consideration on the merits.
If the court believes that the district court abuses discretion in denying a stay because of Panetti and because of Rines.
No, Panetti's a different issue. Rines is the stay issue.
Well, then, Your Honor, I don't have an answer with regard to Panetti, then, on this issue, because it's our position that it is an unripe claim, and I know we run into Panetti again, but that was not an issue that we raised in our brief, or that was raised initially on by Mr. Purvis. It is the government's position that it's an unripe claim, and that it's not second or successive, and that if it is, you run into this court's decision in Hope. Putting that aside, even assuming the court seems to be indicating if there's a Panetti issue, it's still an issue of whether or not under Johnson, Mr. Purvis was diligent. And diligence under the Johnson in the Supreme Court case is the promptness at which the petitioner attacks the state court conviction. And in this case, Mr. Purvis, in 1995, pled guilty and was sentenced to four years when he thought it was three. 12 years later, in June of 2006, when he was sentenced at the federal court, he knew that conviction was going to be used to enhance him as a career offender. Excuse me. And Mr. Purvis did nothing for 14 months.
Well, he didn't actually do nothing.
Under a strict Johnson analysis, in which you look at what Mr. Purvis did to go after his state court conviction, for 14 months he did not pursue that avenue. He didn't attack it. And just as Mr. Purvis argues that the 12 years prior are not relevant, the other avenues that Mr. Purvis took to attack are not relevant under Johnson. because he has not provided an explanation as for what he did for 14 months with regard to attacking his state court conviction. He argues he on appeal. He argued various iterations of the career offender enhancement, but he doesn't say what he did. Now, this Mr. Purvis cites Stewart, but in Stewart, the 11th Circuit said he was diligent. I mean, he immediately attacked. And in this case, Mr. Purvis, knowing for 12 years prior and then for at least 14 months that that conviction was used to enhance his sentence and did nothing. So under the second part of the Johnson analysis is whether or not he acted with diligence. He did not act with diligence in that sense. Unless the court has any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Scarron?
Very briefly, Your Honor. I just want to point out that the 12 years that Mr. Purvis spent between his 1993 conviction and his career offender sentence is completely irrelevant under Johnson versus United States. Johnson explicitly says that there is no reason why you should consider that because the petitioner has no reason to know that it will subsequently be used in a career offender context. And then also in the context of due diligence.
Well, that can't be quite right, can it? I mean, Purvis knew whether he was going to embark on a continuing criminal career, and anybody who wants to be a career criminal has an interest in having his prior convictions set aside to reduce his punishment.
With due respect, Judge Easterbrook, I think that Johnson forecloses that avenue because it explicitly says that in many instances the petitioner will have no reason. There will often be, as there was in this case, two concurrent convictions. In other words, here we had a four-year state sentence running concurrently at the same time as what was a 70-month federal sentence, so there was no reason for Mr. Purvis to attack that conviction.
You're not responding to my point, but it's really not relevant, not necessary.
I'm not sure that the desire to continue on a career of crime is necessarily a relevant.
It actually is the kind of thing that's cited by federal courts when explaining why a collateral attack is not moot even after somebody is released from prison. What the court will say is that the conviction has consequences, including the possibility of a recidivist enhancement, if the defendant commits more crimes. And that's why it's a live case. Now, that kind of recognition about why a case is live even after you're out of prison is the same kind of recognition I was making. And you don't want to deny that. You don't want to challenge fundamental mootness doctrine, I take it.
No, Your Honor, I don't.
Not necessary for you to.
No, it's not necessary for this case.
It would assume a far-thinking criminal who's planning way in advance, which is difficult to conceive.
That is correct, Judge Bauer. If the court has no further questions, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Scarron, and we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement.